Hi, science lovers. Welcome to Hooked on Science. This is a podcast where we learn about cool research that you should know about. I'm your host, Julia Cubans, and it has been a long time no episode. I took a little time away in November. My brain has a little bit of a hard time switching between big tasks, so I was focusing on writing for a bit and trying to work through a big project that I have been wanting to work on for a while. And I'm still not done with it, unfortunately, but I'm back now and excited to be listening and learning along with you. I don't know if you can tell, but I can tell talking, and just because I know, but I had gum surgery last week, so I'm wearing a retainer that kind of makes it sound like my mouth is full of marbles, and I can't, emote as much as I might normally. I can't move my mouth around quite all the way, because I got a bunch of stitches in there right now. But that's just for this intro, so if you notice that, that is why. And next time we chat, I think that this won't be a problem anymore. I'm hoping so, because this is really annoying for me. But anyway, this will be the last regular episode of the year. The next one this month will be a rebroadcast of the most popular episode of 2021. Can you guess what it is? If you want to make a guess, drop me a comment on social media. I'll make a post specifically about, you know, teasing the last episode of the year, and you can let me know what you think. If anyone isn't familiar, the podcast can be found on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and you can find the show by searching on Instagram and Facebook for Hooked on Science Pod, all, you know, one word, no spaces, or you can find the show on Twitter by searching Hooked on Science, again, all one word, no spaces. And if you're not sure, look for the navy background with the little white icons like you see in the, you know, episode picture. There are also links in the show notes if you don't want to type in those handles yourself. I'll also put that poll on Spotify. So for those of you who don't know, Spotify released a new integration where you can actually put polls on the Spotify episode. So if you're listening on Spotify, I think you should be able to see the poll and you can answer it there also and tell me what episode you think it will be if you've been listening for a while and want to make a guess. But it's not just rebroadcast time for the most popular episode. It is also listener survey time, and I would really appreciate if you have a few minutes and if you could take a few minutes to fill out that listener survey. It would really mean a lot to me. It's short, it's only 8 questions long, and you can answer as many or as few as you'd like. And this is to give me an idea of what do you want to learn about in the future? If there are any episodes that you want to hear a follow-up episode on, and also just to tell me about what you like about the show, what could be improved in the future. I love feedback, and I really try to integrate it when I get it, so I look forward to hearing from you. Oh, and I will have a link also in the show notes for that listener survey, so I'm not going to give you a URL right here, right now, but yeah, look in the show notes or on social media. I'll post about it as well. And I really hope you'll take the time to fill it out because it's really helpful for me and for figuring out the future directions of the show. So that's enough business. Let's get into the episode. Today's guest is Ethan Lay, who is a master's student studying agronomy and plant genetics at the University of Minnesota. Ethan is in my lab, so I was really excited to talk with him and catch up on how his research has been going and learning more about what he's doing. So let's learn a little bit about weed science. Hi, Ethan. How is your Tuesday going?
It is great, Julia. I'm excited that it's 45 degrees in Minnesota and it's not quite cold as we approach December.
We had some whispers of cold for a little bit, but it trickled back. I went for a run in shorts yesterday, so that was, exciting.
Yeah, I was debating on wearing shorts today when I went to my class on campus, but decided not to just because you never know with the weather.
Yeah, it can be a real grab bag here, but we're not here to talk about the weather. We're here to talk about science, and weather, that's a whole different science.
Exactly.
We're here to talk about your research, and your research subject is weed science. And before people get ahead of themselves, we're not talking about the marijuana kind of weed. We are talking about the weeds that people don't want around, that might be in your lawn, might be in your garden, might be somewhere where you don't want them to be. I don't know where else. Ethan, how did you get interested in weed science?
So it's actually a long story, or, you know, I can go on a tangent. I grew up in central Iowa, and it's right in the heart of kind of seed production for corn. So I grew up pollinating and detasseling corn. So agriculture's always been in my life. And then, you know, throughout high school, college, I had various jobs throughout different other agricultural operations in Iowa, being in, you know, cornfields, pumpkin patches, apple orchards, and some other, you know, hobby farms. Through all those, you know, I, you know, learned through the management and also the agronomics of things. You know, the one constant across all of these different crops was weeds. And I'd always hear people saying, how do you control this stubborn weed? Or, you know, I don't want quack grass in my yard, and so forth. And so I'd always, you know, perplex me on how we can control those weeds, but also kind of do that within a harmonizing way with, like, kind of using nature and also other things. And so that kind of drove me towards not just weed science, but also kind of a weed biology and weed ecology, which is where my research kind of focuses on.
Interesting. Yeah. So I think people have probably heard about controlling weeds in, you know, maybe like Roundup, things like that. That's kind of a, I don't know, buzzword in, you know, the general population with agriculture and maybe weeds. What are some other ways that people use to control weeds that might not be chemicals, that have some stigma around them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the oldest and tried and true methods for weed control is either hand pulling, or using, you know, a tool such as a hoe or a sickle or something, where you're physically going out there to your garden, your lawn, your field, whatever it may be, and you're physically kind of cutting those plants down or uprooting them from the soil so that they will no longer grow and interfere with your desired plant. Some other methods, you know, at a larger scale would be using, you know, a tillage implement in a large farm field, or you could use, you know, animals in a pasture to kind of continuously graze a certain forage or weed that is, you know, problematic in a natural prairie. Those are kind of two, what we call as physical weed control, but you can also have cultural weed control, which might include, you know, different insects or other pathogens that can kind of control those weeds naturally. And then chemical is the herbicides, as you mentioned. And I know I'm forgetting one. There's four of them. I can't think of the other one, but those are some examples. Yeah.
We hear about things like Roundup and other chemical weed control methods, I guess. Why has that become the dominant, or at least it seems like the dominant way to control weeds, you know, on a large scale, as opposed to some of these other methodologies?
Yeah, so the most obvious answer is just the ease of use and the cost of some of these chemicals compared to, you know, hand labor. I don't know the prices exactly, but you can get a jug of Roundup for, you know, $10-$15 at the store, and you can spray it in your yard, and, you know, you don't have to worry about physically exhausting yourself, where you can just go out there with a little spray tank and go around your yard for, you know, 30 minutes or something. And then as you upscale that to a farm, and it's the same kind of principle where, you know, it's easy to use. You mix a large quantity into a vat of water and spray it out on the field, and usually you get pretty good coverage control over the course of this year. And another big advantage of chemicals was post-planting application, where you could do tillage, pre-plant, you know, some other mechanisms before planting to control some weeds. And then also as those plants emerge after planting, you have the opportunity to come in with a post-product and spray over the top. And so another reason why some chemicals have, you know, been the dominant method is, you know, genetically modified organisms that have given farmers the opportunity to spray something over the top of their crop, killing everything except their desired crop.
Okay, so I guess we kind of put the cart before the horse, but this is kind of maybe the clickbaity title, like, what are the dangers of weeds? Like, they're just other plants. Why do we need to get rid of them?
So the number one problem would be competition. And so in agronomic production fields, or any field for that matter, a weed, or as I like to call a plant out of place or an undesired plant, is competing with that desired crop for nutrients such as light, soil moisture, other soil nutrients. And they are competing against this crop, and most of the time weeds have other specific traits that make them more advantageous for competition. So they compete well against these crops and most of the time outcompete them. Mm-hmm. And so along those lines of kind of protecting your investment, where you give it enough time to establish where it can, you know, get over that bump and compete naturally with those weeds.
So this is kind of a hypothetical question. I'm on just the plant side of things. I don't know a lot about the weed side of things anymore. I've erased that part of my memory bank. But why don't we just make our crops more competitive with the weeds? Like, have people tried to do that? Are there ways to do it? You don't have to answer that if you don't know the answer.
That's a good question. There are always certain traits you can, you know, breed for, or, you know, try and genetically insert into a crop. The thing that comes to my mind is, you know, competition is this, you know, multifunctional thing that when you're making a breeding pipeline, how do you know which things are going to be the best to compete for? And, you know, what traits are you looking for? Where, you know, they've done that with soil water utilization and, you know, photosynthetic efficiency and stuff like that, where they're able to kind of outcompete. And I know one specific example is kind of the canopy closure in soybeans, where you can breed for soybeans that are going to close that gap between rows, and that's going to limit the light interception in those inner rows and also kind of reduce the amount of sunlight getting to those weeds. And so that's just one example that I know of, you know, the breeding for faster closure to kind of, you know, be a natural weed suppressant.
Interesting. Yeah, because I was just, as you were saying that, it's like, why don't we have crops that have bigger leaves or something like that earlier than, you know, they often do? Because, I mean, they start tiny. They're just plants. But some of them get so big, but like, why don't we just make them get wide?
Another thing I can think of is when we're growing a crop, especially an annual like corn or soybeans, there's only a finite amount of time for, you know, growth and development into the vegetative part. And then a lot of it is put up into that seed, seed head. And so you can get to you can get really large leaves, but it's this, you know, perfect unison of trying to find how much can we get, how much do we need, and before we can get to that grain fill and such.
That's true. Most people aren't growing their plants for the leaf. They're growing it for the seed or the fruit, whatever that may be. Complicated. Plants are complicated, people.
Exactly.
So when we think of weeds, I mean, if people, you know, are not familiar with cropping systems, or maybe they have a small garden or just maintaining a lawn, like, weeds crop up all the time. It's not like there is a specific time of the year where it's like, oh, it's July 2nd, we need to control for our weeds right now. It's time to go pull all the weeds out of the yard this time of the year. How does that complicate trying to, you know, control for weeds, trying to, you know, manage weeds so that you can have a good hardy crop, as opposed to a crop that is experiencing a lot of competition with the weeds around it?
Yes, so that's a great question, and it causes a lot of problems in today's agriculture, because we're posed with producing high yields, but also, you know, providing inputs and also controlling other things to, you know, to get those yields. And weeds are one of those things that interfere. So one of the biggest theories around kind of weeds and crops is this thing called the critical weed threshold. And it's a period during a crop's growth that they need to be weed free or have no or little competition. And so no matter when weeds are, you know, emerging and growing, it all depends on this kind of relative critical weed threshold of when does the crop need to be, you know, kind of nurtured and, you know, very, very protected. And so generally it's, you know, a few weeks after these plants are planted and they start to emerging. I think in corn, it might be 4 to 6 weeks, and then it's, you know, a couple weeks after that. But various crops differ, and, you know, some can only need it for like a week, but some need it for 2 or 3 weeks. And so that's a really big thing around, you know, annual agriculture. But then having weeds that actually emerge at different times is actually advantageous, because then it allows a farmer to control them at different times throughout the year, or also implement other practices in their management techniques. And so one really common technique that's been used in the past is called delayed planting, where in the spring you let some weeds emerge, and then you come through with possibly a chisel plow or something to control those weeds, and then you go through and plant your crop if you're worried about a specific weed that's going to emerge. It's very common in organic agriculture, where you know, some of those post herbicide applications are not allowed or available, and so just kind of working with nature in those different ways is an advantage.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like there is a lot of strategy involved in that. You know, maybe some of that or a lot of that has to happen at the beginning of the season when the crops are small and can't fend for themselves in that critical weed-free period. So I think that's a really good segue into the research you're doing on pre-emergence herbicides and crops. Can you give me, like, you know, a global description of what you're working on?
Yeah. So my research looks at this whole realm of integrating cover crops into the corn and soybean system in the Midwest. So the Midwest makes up roughly 80 to 90% of the, you know, total U.S. corn and soybean produced. I'm not sure about specifics there, but we are only putting a crop on our landscape for a very short period of time, and we are leaving the landscape bare for 5 to 6 months out of the year. And this is usually termed as the fallow period. And so one, you know, really key thing in conservation practices and global security with, you know, producing our food is kind of protecting the most, you know, important research to agriculture, and that is the soil. And cover crops are one way to do that, where they are planted in the off season between two cash crops, between corn and soybeans. And then they grow and they provide soil protection and other advantages to the system, such as, you know, building soil health, providing nitrogen in some cases, but also, you know, they can suppress weeds, also be a forage for animals. And so that's kind of the big idea, is we would want to incorporate cover crops into our corn and soybean system. However, there are a lot of other moving parts within agriculture in today's production system. And one of those is, you know, these different weeds emerging at different times. And some of them are starting to be more problematic than others. And so, you know, farmers are tasked with controlling early season weeds, but also there's late emerging weeds that are persisting and causing problems to these farmers. And so my research looks at, okay, if our number one objective is how do we control these problematic late emerging weed species in a system? And if we're going to do that, currently what's being recommended by the University of Minnesota of Extension is the use of these pre-emergent herbicides. And those are applied on the soil surface and either before the plant is planted or shortly after, and they persist in the soil and they slowly inhibit the emergence of these weed seedlings. What we want to know is if we're using these pre-emergent herbicides but also trying to incorporate cover crops into the system, is there any carryover the next fall if we apply these pre-emergent herbicides in the spring, will affect the growth and establishment of these cover crops planted in the fall? And will that affect any of the intended benefits a grower intends to get from planting cover crops?
Okay. So just to kind of like nail down this timeline concisely. So in the spring, you know, May-ish, we're planting either corn or soybean in this system. And yeah, plus or minus a few weeks, we're also applying this pre-emergent herbicide. And then the corn and the soybean is going through its life cycle unaffected, ideally, by this herbicide. You wouldn't apply it, hopefully, if it was going to kill your crop immediately. And then after that corn and soybean are harvested, you're then planting a cover crop and wondering how that herbicide you planted in, you know, May is going to be affecting it in September, October, November, right?
Yep, that is it.
All right, perfect. I just wanted to make sure everybody knows what the timeline is. That's an important piece of this. Okay, so as I was just like saying, so these are not affecting your corn or soybean crop at all, right?
Nope, they are picked for the use in those intended crops. But a lot of these herbicides do not have restrictions or enough information regarding cover crops.
Okay.
And so generally, if you look on the backside of a herbicide label, it says kind of some rotation guidelines of if you intend to follow this crop with X, then you need to wait a month, 2 months, 6 months, 9 months, whatever it may be. But a lot of the instructions for cover crops are a little ambiguous, not kind of clear how they might affect it. And so what we want to know is kind of test that with some current recommendations for late emerging weeds.
Okay. And so like, would those recommendations, are like most of them considering what you'd be putting in like the next year as opposed to what you'd be putting in immediately after these crops?
Yes.
Okay.
Generally it's, you know, in a rotation. So going from corn to soybeans or corn to like alfalfa or a wheat or something else, because all of these crops have different histories, you know, different progress in breeding, and so some of them are more sensitive to some of these chemicals than others, just depending on how important it's been through their life cycle of the traits they need and so forth. And so it's a, you know, a really important thing to consider for a farmer if they have to look down the road and they intend to plant a certain crop. They need to know if they intend to use this product that there might be consequences.
Yeah, for sure. So like doing this research, what is the benefit to doing it with, you know, the corn or soybean directly in rotation instead of just being, okay, we're going to grow this cover crop and we're going to spray this herbicide on it and see what happens. I mean, obviously there's like the time component of it's sitting in the soil and, you know, seeing how it degrades and whatnot, but have there been, you know, preliminary studies, maybe not in rotation, to be like, all right, we're going to spray, I don't know a lot of chemical herbicide names, but we're going to spray like X chemical on this rye and see if it dies.
My research is really interested in the applied setting and how it, you know, how everything works together in a system out on a farmer's field or out in, you know, the applied world. There has been studies looking at certain carryover in some greenhouse pots or, you know, spraying certain chemicals on these crops. But we want to know is, you know, if you're using it in one crop, is there, you know, how is it interacting with the environment, nature, that's intended crop, and then, you know, the soil series and everything, all these working parts, and then how is it in that soil when you plant the cover crop?
I mean, I think with all applied research, there's a lot of moving parts. And I think that within that, I mean, if you go outside, just, you know, as a human, you can be like exposed to wind and sunlight and rain. So yeah, I mean, it would make sense that you would want to see how all those factors, you know, just over time affect it. But how do you try to parse out like those different things? Like say like it's a really rainy year. Is that going to affect the cover crop, you know, in terms of the pre-emergent herbicide more than like a really sunny year, a hot year? Like how does that kind of thing factor into this?
So we try and kind of consider those things when we're you know, looking at the data afterwards and kind of drawing some conclusions with the results we have. And really all we can do from the experiment side is look at the results we got and the climatic conditions that we observed those in. And so just for example, the study I did was a 2-year study, and we had above average rainfall and normal rainfall in those 2 years. And we did not see any significant, you know, damage on our cover crops, but this past year we had a drought. And so our, you know, kind of assumption was with the drought this past summer, those herbicides might've remained in the soil profile longer, and that would have increased their possibility of carryover into the fall, but we really can't know. And, you know, it's kind of a case by case, year by year thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. We haven't talked a lot about the specific herbicides you've chosen, and I don't think we need to get into the nitty gritty details about this, but the ones that you are using in this experiment, would these be typical for what you would see like on a farm in Minnesota that would be applied? Or are these kind of like new formulations that we're just kind of learning about? And so we're, you know, hatching this research to try and to learn more about the whole system in general while we're also learning about these herbicides.
So the ones that we're using in this experiment have been around for several years. They're not necessarily new. They're just coming back into the picture because of all these problematic late emerging weeds that have developed some sort of herbicide resistant to some of our post products. And so now farmers and researchers are looking at, you know, other ways to control them. And so that's why pre-emergent herbicides are kind of coming back into the picture of, you know, utilizing those more compared to these post products.
We've been talking a lot about early emerging weeds and the pre-emergent herbicides. And so like an early emerging weed, that makes sense. Like, you know, it's spring, things start to green up. Most people can look outside and imagine when an early emerging weed would come out. April, May, early June, that kind of time. When we're talking about late emerging weeds, like what does that mean? Are we talking like late in terms of like the summer, like August, September? Or are we talking like late in terms of the whole year, like October, November? What does that look like?
So when I say that, we're really referring to the growing season. And so generally the growing season is from, depending if it's corn or soybeans, usually kind of the last week of April, May, and then all the way until August, September. And then, you know, things start to die off and senesce. But late emerging usually is, you know, a month or two after you grow these crops, they're starting to kind of emerge and having their peak emergence.
Okay. So it's still relatively early in the year. So like we're applying herbicides to tackle weed problems in like June, July, not at the same time that you would be planting these cover crops.
Correct.
Okay.
Now there are chemicals out there that, you know, they have a long persistence in the soil that you could use to control those, but that's not really the intent of this experiment, to try and get control all the way up to the cover crop growth.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So we've been kind of talking about cover crops broadly, but you're looking at specific cover crops. It's not like you're just taking a bag labeled cover crop and throwing it onto the ground saying, we'll see what comes up. What cover crops are you looking at for this research, or what did you look at, and why those ones?
Yes, so for my research, we chose to look at cover crops that are representative of, you know, some of the different families or groups that, you know, are commonly available out there in the market. And so for mine, we used three, being winter rye, which is a grass, and that is generally used for sometimes a forage or also just kind of a mat covering, some weed suppressive capabilities. Then the second one we chose was red clover, and red clover is a legume, and the legumes are commonly used to provide nitrogen and fix nitrogen into the soil, and so they provide a nitrogen source for an upcoming crop. And then lastly, we used winter camelina, which is a brassica, and it's also being developed here at the University of Minnesota as an winter oilseed crop. And so that's kind of a cash cover crop where, you know, a farmer could use it as another source of revenue on their farm. And so we're using all three of those just to kind of get a, you know, a baseline of those, the three different groups of kind of cover crops that are out there, and, you know, how are they being affected by these specific chemicals used to control late emerging weeds.
Sure. And if anybody is interested in learning more about camelina specifically, there are, I think, one episode that we've talked about camelina. That was episode 10, where we talked about winter oilseed breeding with Dr. Catherine Frels. So if you are dying to know more about camelina, you want to catch up, go listen to that. But from an agricultural perspective, these are all like pretty different plants, cover crops. How did your different herbicides affect them?
So we did not find a significant impact of these herbicides on those three cover crops, mainly because in the years of the study, we had very high rainfall, and temperatures were also high. And so we really think that the microbial populations degraded those herbicides faster than they would have in a drought year. We also had, you know, some pretty bad establishment issues with our red clover, but looking at just the winter rye and the camelina, we did not see any significant decrease in the biomass of those cover crops. And ultimately, that's really what a farmer is going to be looking at when they're growing these cover crops, is biomass usually dictates the ecosystem services or the benefit of these cover crops, because the more biomass, the larger the weed suppression, you know, the greater the oil seed, the greater the forage. And so that's what we were looking at to see if there was a significant decrease in the spring biomass of these cover crops.
Okay, so that sounds like it was good news then.
Yeah, which I don't want to, you know, endorse it there, but, you know, we're just doing the research. And I always like to tell farmers that, you know, case by case, it's always, you know, different things. So trying it on their farm first is, you know, the best way to kind of use the resources we're developing in at the University of Minnesota.
Sure. And so I think, I don't know if you looked at this part of it, but there's obviously like a huge economic component always to these agricultural, you know, experiments from the farmer perspective. If they're going to take the chance and the risk to try this out, it's going to cost money as far as getting new seed and the time and whatnot. I'm guessing that they would always, or they would already be putting like the herbicides on their fields for the most part. So that's not necessarily an added cost, but how does that kind of portion look, or do you, you know, not know about that side of it?
So I know a little bit about it, and there are a lot of government subsidies out there and programs that, you know, help get cover crops on the landscape. Last I checked, I think in Minnesota, we have about 5% of our land that's cover cropped over the winter. And so we're really pushing to kind of get our soil covered in the off season and protect that resource. And another big reason is we're in Minnesota, the land of 10,000 more, 11,000. I always forget which number they use. But a big thing is, you know, kind of some of this runoff coming from agricultural fields, and cover crops are a way to kind of reduce that, or, you know, kind of uptake some of that and reduce that risk into some of our, you know, precious lakes and streams that so many Minnesotans love to enjoy. And so, yes, cover crops are always going to be, you know, another thing on the expense sheet, but there are options and, you know, programs out there that, you know, can help reduce that cost. And also thinking in the long term of, if you use a cover crop for weed suppression, then, you know, you might be able to reduce your herbicide inputs. If you use it for, you use a legume, it's reducing your fertilizer application. And so there's a lot of things to consider. And so there's just so many moving things that just have to be taken into account and weighed out and kind of figured out how they work in a system.
Okay. So within all this, like, you're looking at herbicides and you're mainly looking at cover crops, but obviously you're in the weed science sector, but we haven't talked, you know, specifically about any one weed or any group of weeds that might be problematic right now. Does that come into your research at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something that I'm constantly, you know, learning and applying towards my research. And so when we are kind of evaluating this project or experiment, it is, you know, important to take mental notes of your field plots and everything. And one of those along the lines is the weed pressure in these cover crops and kind of the weed diversity or density. And so we are taking some casual notes on the weeds that are present. And, you know, the big thing about weed identification is identifying what weeds are there. So weed identification is a critical part to any, I mean, in my opinion, any agronomist or anyone that works in a field relating to crop growth.
What does identifying weeds look like?
There's kind of two ways to go about weed identification. The first being you identify it with your sight, and you kind of just look at it out there and you say, okay, that's, you know, common lamb's quarter, or that's common cocklebur, that's, you know, that's crabgrass, whatever. And that takes time. You know, it's a skill you learn by looking at different features on, you know, the leaves, different morphological patterns. But the most common is using a dichotomous or trichotomous key. in several universities, their extension services, books, they're all out there. They have field guides, and you can just, you kind of take it and you look at different features on the plant and say, okay, is the cotyledon linear? Is it spatulate? Are the stems hairy? How are the leaves arranged? And so that's the most common way of identifying it.
Sounds like you need to know a lot of vocabulary and some, I don't know, nitty gritty little things. I remember when I took a weed science class, I mean, it was like 7-8 years ago now, but we had a book, Weeds of the Northeast, that the first, I don't know, 50 pages at least were just a key of being like, how does the leaf wrap around the stem? Like, is it this shape? Is it this shape? And it was like, man, this is really this is really something. So do you enjoy that identification part? Are people just like coming up to you with weeds or sending you pictures to be like, what is this? I need help.
A little bit of both. So I enjoy it just because, you know, I'm constantly challenging myself of what I've learned in classes and also in the field. But I also get to apply it towards something, you know, I enjoy, which is, you know, helping others. So I'm constantly at home and, you know, when my parents' grass looks horrendous and I tell them to do this or that, and I have to tell them why, you know, it's, you know, reassuring to just know, okay, well, you have this weed, you should, you know, do this, do that. But also just kind of knowing if a weed's problematic or not, because we've talked a lot about weeds. But there's also kind of different categories within kind of these weeds of being kind of noxious, which are, you know, very, you know, invasive. And so kind of knowing, you know, if you have an invasive weed or noxious weed in your field, you know, it's monumental because then you can take action right away versus waiting down the line and having someone come in and tell you, oh yeah, you have a problem now and it's going to take this much to you know, control it and you have to do these steps. And, you know, sometimes they might tell you to take acres out of production to control it or, you know, contain a spread. And so kind of knowing a certain weed is very beneficial. It's also just kind of fun because most weeds, they've been around in our, you know, the world forever. And so a lot of remedies out there that actually, you know, center around weeds and, you know, they're actually, there's a lot of uses for them. It's just, we haven't found our use in today's society for them. Like a great example is the invention of Velcro was actually proposed because of a weed such as cocklebur or common burdock that actually has very spiny like projectiles or burrs on their seed heads that would stick to clothes. And so that's, you know, one way a weed shaped into today's society.
Yeah, that's so cool. And I mean, I think people who have been listening to the show for a while have heard me talk about pennycress with guests. That's my first research, I don't know, love in grad school was pennycress. And that was a weed and still is a weed in a lot of places, but is becoming a cash cover crop like camelina that we were talking about earlier. It can have a bunch of different uses, and so maybe all these weeds out there soon were, or maybe in the next, you know, 100 years, 1,000 years, we're gonna find something cool to do with them, or maybe they'll inspire something else, like I don't know, Velcro 2.0. Who knows? But Ethan, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about weed science and your projects. Is there anywhere people can go if they want to learn more about what you're working on, you know, get, I don't know, updates as you finalize this research?
Yeah, so the best resource would be the University of Minnesota Extension Crops website. I will be working on an article in the next month or so, kind of summarizing my research and also talking about some other interesting things within kind of the weed science and agronomic fields with the speculated kind of herbicide shortages and other things that are going to affect some planting operations in 2022.
Okay, very cool. And if anybody's listening in, I guess like January or so, I'll put a link to that article. Well, Ethan, thank you again for joining me, and I hope you have a good rest of your week.
Yeah, thanks, Julia. You too.
Yeah, for sure. That land stewardship piece is definitely huge and can totally benefit a farmer from year to year. Is there anything else that you want to mention about this project before we move on?
Sure. So this project's just the foreground for other research that's to come. So kind of another part that goes along this research is also now looking at kind of the weed suppression capabilities of these specific cover crops, and looking at the different things they do in the environment to kind of mediate some of the emergence, so we can kind of tailor it with this experiment as well. So now that we know that these herbicides used to control late emerging weeds are not affecting cover crops, now we can look at, okay, how are these cover crops kind of controlling weeds early on in the season? And then that goes into this whole other scheme of integrated weed management, which is using many little hammers to achieve, the larger goal.